Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds, the associate producer of The Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, The Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, May 14th, Joe was out and Sarah LaDuke hosted. She was joined by semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist, editorial writer for the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz, professor emeritus of Russian at Hofstra University and the author of A Liberal Vanguard, Populist Elitism in the United States and Russia, Alexander Mihailovich, former editor of the Daily Gazette and former vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, and senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Robert Pondicio.
We're going to begin this morning with an education story. There was an article in the New York Times a few days ago about the lack of focus in the administration and all levels of government nearly about education for our children. This set up from the New York Times. For decades, both Republicans and Democrats strove to be seen as champions of student achievement. Politicians believed pushing for stronger reading and math skills wasn't just a responsibility, it was potentially a winning electoral strategy. But at the moment, it seems as though neither party nor even a single major political figure is vying to claim that mantle. President Trump has been fixated in his second term on imposing ideological obedience in schools. He's begun a bevy of investigations on how schools handle race and transgender issues and has demanded that the curriculum be patriotic, a priority he does not have the power to enact since curriculum is set by states and school districts. Excuse me. Democrats, for their part, often find themselves standing up for a status quo that seems to satisfy no one. Governors and congressional leaders are defending the Department of Education as President Trump has threatened to abolish it. Liberal groups are suing to block funding cuts. When Kamala Harris was running for president last year, she spoke about student loan forgiveness and resisting right-wing book bans, but none of that amounts to an agenda on learning either. All of this is true despite the fact that reading scores are the lowest they have been in decades after a pandemic that devastated children by shuttering their schools and sending them deeper and deeper into the realm of screens and social media. No wonder Americans are increasingly cynical about higher education. Satisfaction with public education is at a quarter-century low, and enrollment in public schools has declined since the pandemic as well. According to polls, concerns about the curriculum are one reason. But large majorities of voters are enthusiastic about schools doing a better job at teaching the core academic subjects and civics, as well as introducing more workforce training. So why aren't politicians responding to voters' concerns when it comes to learning? And that is where we jump off this morning. Robert, would you like to begin?
I would like to begin, and you're going to have to cut me off at some point, because I could spend hours talking about this. I mean, in fact, it's literally my day job talking about this. I work in the education policy world. So, yeah, you know, this piece kind of hits the nail on the head. I was a little bit sorry that it didn't echo around more, because this is a critical issue. And it resonates with me because I became a public school teacher during that kind of halcyon moment of, you know, bipartisanship on education. Circa 2002, I left my job at Business Week magazine to go teach in the South Bronx and stayed there for several years. Never left education. And this is a problem. And it's useful to recall why there was bipartisanship in 2002. Frankly, it was a national embarrassment, you know, particularly the achievement gap, which is mentioned in the article. There was just a national sense of shame over how badly we were failing public education in general, and particularly low-income kids of color in places like the South Bronx where I taught. So for this brief moment, you had both Democrats and Republicans supporting charter schools, supporting accountability, testing, standards, raising achievement, closing that achievement gap. Now, you know, if we had, you know, hours to talk about this, we could talk about, you know, where that movement fell short. But the point was, there was bipartisan agreement around that movement, and it's all fallen apart. On the right, folks are more interested in school choice and parental rights. I happen to support those things. Those are very good things. The left has rekindled its romance with public sector unions and traditional public schools, which, may I remind people, have failed for generations. So, you know, it's that, what is that thing that about that Einstein used to say about, you know, doing the same thing and expecting a different result. So it's a frankly a depressing moment right now where we are, it feels like Back to the Future. It's not 2002 right now. It's like 1992 before that movement coalesced. So here's hoping that, you know, we can set aside whatever partisan disagreements we have and remind ourselves why this movement took off 20 years ago and at least rekindle a little bit of that on behalf of children.
Judy?
Oh, over the years, there have been so many education fads that we have covered. And, you know, there was the No Child Left Behind.
Right.
There was the... and, you know, what you do need to do is talk to teachers, to talk to the people who have graduated. And, I mean, we went through a phase just recently where it was all the focus was on STEM education and whether or not that deprived the students of important skills in other realms like civics or like the literature and social studies.
Right, so, general vocabulary building through, et cetera.
Right. Yeah. You know, when you talk to... There are some people in the education field that say, unless you can measure it, it didn't happen. And you get a lot of pushback from teachers who say, you know, there was a time when we were just teaching to the test and we were not teaching. We were just teaching kids how to answer questions. And that took away from the development of other skills that we thought were important. I used to cover, you know, a school district that had very low test scores for students, Schenectady. And efforts to increase those scores, you know, they just failed again and again. And oftentimes it's not a matter of funding because New York State schools are very well funded. But
sure
in New York State, there is a great disparity from the city of Niskayuna or the town of Niskayuna school district, which is a very wealthy school district, and the city of Schenectady, which is a poor district, and their ability to, you know, what happens with those students and what happens with the city of Schenectady students.
Can I point out, this is not just a political story. This is a public story as well. I write a lot about education. Last year, I spent a lot of time in the city of Houston for a deep dive piece on Houston school reforms. And I could not help but be struck by the lack of public support for those efforts. So, you know, again, it wasn't just bipartisan support 20 years ago. You had movies like Waiting for Superman. You had, you know, op-eds and whatnot, people supporting this idea, hey, we really need to do right by kids. It was, I wrote in this piece for a magazine called Education Next that the guy who was behind these reforms, a guy named Mike Miles, that mayflies have longer lives than his honeymoon period. In other words, when he was installed by the state to turn around Houston, right away, I hate it, I hate him, I'm not interested. The public hates it, parents hate it, the business community is, all the folks who used to support this stuff 20, 25 years ago are now, I'm not interested.
You know, you don't see a lot of like it's school budget vote time here in New York State, and for many years we saw a lot of those budgets get rejected. I think the school districts have done a better job now of getting the word out and trying to help those budgets get passed and the referenda that follow get passed. But I'll be anxious to see because people do come out and vote against school budgets. Oftentimes, they are voting against what they perceive as high salaries for teachers. You know, it's less than it used to be, but certainly there's that element, especially when property taxes are so high in New York State.
Are you sure about that? Last time I looked, school budgets in New York pass at a rate overnight, like at a rate that would make Castro blush, like 98%.
And the rejections are the exception to the rule, but it's oftentimes what we're seeing nowadays is the people will vote for them because they know the contingency budgets often just maintain the same level of funding.
I always assume they vote for them because the elections are held in the schools where the people who have the most at stake are voting at their office.
They have to pass by those student art exhibits that are so darn cute.
Exactly.
They are
exactly
great.
Right.
I do
that's
love
right.
those.
That's right.
Alex?
Yeah.
Well, one quotation in this article from the Times really spoke to me as somebody who has taught at a range of schools, you know, at the higher education level. I've taught at Hofstra, I've taught at Brown, Williams, and Bennington College, and Columbia. And here, some teachers are moving in-class reading and writing back to paper. As somebody who's taught not, you know, who teaches, you know, from time to time, you know, even now, even my semi-retirement, you know, at Williams and Bennington, I can tell you that this is really an acute concern in all classrooms, that there should not be any electronic devices. This particular middle school, high school teacher in Providence, Rhode Island, now requires his students to close their laptops and read on paper. Their reading comprehension is stronger.
Yeah.
And this is becoming actually a kind of a wave in some quarters of higher education. I know this just anecdotally and just, you know, reading in the Chronicle of Higher Education. I have a colleague who teaches at NYU, a course on Russian literature, and now it's a completely electronics-free space. She's gone back to using blue books. And as a result, the students are much more engaged with the content of what they are reading, and they're able to discuss it, engage with their peers in the classroom much more effectively.
Yeah.
I think this is very important. And I think that, you know, one other point that's raised in the article about, you know, the fact that both social studies and science instruction have the capability of expanding vocabulary.
Oh,
what you're really giving students is kind of the tools, the communicative tools, to deal in this, function in the social sphere in general. Not to speak, of course, also of the benefit of specific skills for, you know, this or that job. So I think that bridging that gap between the view of education as instrumental, you want to get a good career and have a good paying job, and something that gives you a kind of, I don't know how you would put it, almost a kind of social spiritual toolkit,
nice.
Is something that needs to be, you know, addressed, I think, at all levels of the education system right now.
Yeah, what you're referring to, by the way, and if we had more time, we could unpack this. One of the reasons that this became so unpopular is because of the overreactions to standards and accountability. What you're just describing, this phenomenon of kids not reading on paper or books anymore.
Right.
You know, No Child Left Behind, say what you will, it was supposed to make bad schools look more like good schools. It has tended sometimes to do the opposite. In other words, you don't read full novels anymore. You read what my friend David Steiner, our former ed commissioner in the state, calls bleeding chunks of literature.
Right.
In other words, it has narrowed the curriculum. You're not getting that rich science and art and music and history that you used to get. And that's not the entire reason, but that's part of the reason why people have turned against these reforms.
Jay, did you want to weigh in on the education story?
God, yes. all right. So there's so much to unpack from this piece. It was just, there were parts of it that disappointed me. Parts of it that really made me grate my teeth, and parts of it that gnash my teeth.
Let me mention, it is in the New York Times, and the headline is, "Has America Given Up on Children's Learning?" If anybody out there would like to read the entire piece, we're not reading the whole thing on air, of course.
The first thing I think of whenever whenever this discussion happens is I think about a conversation that took place in 1998 at the Saratoga County Fair. I remember this like it was yesterday. John Sweeney, Congressman John Sweeney, who imploded in all sorts of other ways, and I happened to be walking from the parking lot to a place where he was going to speak, and we got into a discussion about teacher accountability. It was a strong, strong Republican initiative to do teacher accountability. Now, it was a strong Republican initiative for a reason, which, you know, was somewhat anti-teacher union. But eventually there was, as you mentioned, bipartisan consensus around this idea that we do need some accountability in schools. And to this day, I think that's not a bad thing if you're, you know, genuine about it. The problem was it became high stakes. It got out of control. You went through NCLB, No Child Left Behind. Then you went through Common Core. Then you went through Cuomo's incarnation of the whole thing where we're going to start shutting down schools and putting them in putting them in receivership. And the whole thing, and Cuomo was hostile to unions as well. All this became this political football, and maybe because we've often argued in editorial board meetings that we need to be teaching civics a lot more, not Donald Trump's patriotism business, but we need to be teaching a basic understanding of civics in all its forms, from what the free press is to what government is and all that and what the roles are. And I lost, had some momentum there. Yeah. It eventually became a problem that the there seemed to be a backlash to everything. If you did one thing, the public just reacted to it, and it was bipartisan. As the piece pointed out, that it was bipartisan objection to high stakes testing, and so you got conservatives who were against Common Core and Cuomo's initiatives, and then you got liberals who were keeping their kids home from the tests because they didn't want their kids upset.
That's right.
And they said they were too stressed out, and maybe they were. I wasn't a kid. Full-grown adult.
Well, can I just say that tests don't stress kids out. Teachers stress kids out about tests. Right.
Yeah.
And the other point I want to make about accountability, because this is really where things left the rails, right? And I've made myself very unpopular at ed reform convenings over the last 20 years, and my ed reform credentials, I hope, are in good order. But I always point this out. The logic of teacher accountability is, hey, teacher, hey, school, you know what to do. We just need to hold you accountable for it. And as somebody who has been through ed school, I'm always quick to say, where did you get this idea that ed schools are preparing teachers for classroom success? Because I promise you they're not. Mm-hmm. So the inherent logic model doesn't make sense.
That was Robert Pondicio on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, May 14th. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, May 16th, Joe was out and Sarah LaDuke hosted. She was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Joseph Palamountain Jr. Chair in Government at Skidmore College, Beau Breslin, attorney and former U.S. Congressperson and NY Assemblyperson John Faso, and Siena College Professor of Economics Aaron Pacitti.
Let us discuss. We will start with yesterday's birthright citizenship oral arguments in the Supreme Court. Yesterday, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments. I'm setting this up with text from the SCOTUS blog, which is a very helpful resource. And if you'd like to, you know, study for yourself, it's scotusblog.com. Yesterday, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the federal government's effort to be able to generally implement President Trump's executive order ending birthright citizenship, the guarantee of citizenship to virtually everyone born in the United States. President Trump set the events leading to Thursday's arguments in motion on January 20th when he signed the executive order ending birthright citizenship. Under the order, which was originally slated to go into effect on February 19th, children born in the United States would no longer automatically be entitled to U.S. citizenship if their parents were in this country illegally or temporarily, for example, on a work or student visa. Birthright citizenship was written into the Constitution following the Civil War when the 14th Amendment was adopted in 1868. With the words, "All persons born or naturalized in the United States," the amendment established the citizenship of black people, including former enslaved people freed during the war, who had been denied that right in the Supreme Court's notorious 1857 decision, Dred Scott versus Sanford. During arguments yesterday, the Supreme Court appeared divided over whether a federal judge has the power to block President Trump's executive order ending birthright citizenship while the case moves through the lower courts. The Trump administration told the justices it should be able to at least partly implement the order, although several justices in recent years have expressed skepticism about so-called nationwide injunctions, which bar the government from enforcing a law or policy anywhere in the country. During more than 2 hours of oral arguments, it was not clear whether a majority of the justices were ready to bar such injunctions altogether. Arguments on Thursday mostly steered clear of the question of whether Trump's order is legal under the Constitution, which is known as the merits of the case, instead focusing mostly on procedural questions. We invited Beau Breslin specifically today because he's a Constitution guy, to help us understand and discuss. I would like you to begin, Beau.
Oh, thanks, Sarah. I promise not to monopolize. I could spend a lot of time talking about this. But let me just say a couple things. Those who tuned into oral argument thinking that this would be a civics lesson in 14th Amendment birthright citizenship were probably a little disappointed, because it is a largely technical question about whether or not universal or nationwide injunctions is appropriate or applicable. So I'll just throw a couple of things out on the table and then open it up for the conversation. One is 2 points about injunctions, right? So about nationwide injunctions. One, I think the media's off, including SCOTUS blog. I listened to oral argument. I've listened to a lot of oral arguments before, and it seems to me that it's not quite as divided as people are saying. And I read the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal, and they all seem to think that it's divided. I don't think so. You know, you have Brett Kavanaugh saying certain things. I actually think the court is kind of painted into a corner here, because injunctions are important, and nationwide injunctions have been used. And the argument about whether or not you can use class action suits as opposed to nationwide injunctions, it was pretty clear to me that the court thinks that class action suits are not expeditious enough. And so I actually think the media is wrong. I think this one will be largely one-sided. There might be a couple people who, Thomas and others, who disagree. But I think this will be a fairly easy case for the court to say, yeah, unfortunately, we don't love injunctions, but we're nationwide injunctions, I should say. But we have no alternative. And so I think the court will come down on the side of New Jersey in this, or the states in this that particular thing. Two, I would say the court's emphasis is there are injunctions and then there are injunctions. An injunction about the 14th Amendment, which I'll get to in a second, an injunction about birthright citizenship carries a little bit more weight than an injunction about sort of a routine construction project or something like that. So I actually think the court is aware of the fact that this is a bigger deal in terms of birthright citizenship than just a traditional other sort of routine injunction. So then I'll say two things about, I also will mention, this is a little bit of judicial chicanery, a little bit of judicial trickery. The U.S. government, Sowers is the attorney, solicitor general. He wants to have the argument about injunctions because ultimately he does not want to have the argument about the merits of the case, about birthright citizenship. That said, I'm going to go out on a limb here on the air, risky, risky moment, and say I actually think the question of whether or not the court will support this kind of unorthodox birthright citizenship question, which we can get to, I think that'll be closer than the injunction question. That is to say, I think there are conservative members of the court, in particular Alito and Thomas, who might in fact agree that those temporarily here are not subject to the jurisdiction, quote unquote, thereof. And as a result, I actually think the birthright citizenship, the actual merits of the case, will be a little bit closer than the injunction question. My final point before I open it up is, damn, you know, sorry, folks.
No, that's okay.
This is the 14th Amendment we're talking about.
Teresa fainted. It's okay.
I'm reaching for the dumb button.
No. We can do one of those.
I mean, I just got to spend a moment saying and just acknowledging that the 14th Amendment is the greatest triumph of modern liberalism. And I don't mean liberalism as in democratic liberalism. It's about universal equality. It's about the protections of due process. And yes, it's about citizenship, the expansion of the tent of citizens, right? There have been many moments where we've had the expansion of the tent of citizens. When women got the right to vote, that was an expansion of the tent of citizenship. The first sentence was meant to settle the great question of citizenship. It was intended to constitutionalize the Civil Rights Act of 1866, but ultimately, this is the most, arguably second only to the Declaration of Independence in terms of the majesty of American liberalism, the character of American liberalism is the 14th Amendment, and Trump decides on day one he's going to take pot shots at it. I just don't get it. And I'll leave it at that.
John Faso.
I think Bo has given us a pretty good description of the matter. The media has gotten it a bit wrong because it's not really about the substance of the issue. It's going to be about the procedure. And there have been a number of instances, both from judges who were perceived on the left or right, where they impose nationwide injunctions. And what that does, it kind of short-circuits the legal process, because you could have the whole purpose is to have cases percolate through the system. Ultimately, if there's a dispute between and among different circuits, court of appeals, then the issue gets resolved at the Supreme Court level. And there's a benefit to that because you have the virtue of different opinions, different legal analysis being brought to the fore in front of the Supreme Court ultimately, and then they can decipher and discern what should be the right outcome from a constitutional perspective. So I think that the issue of a nationwide injunction have been overused, but the question is going to be here whether, as Bo said, whether that is just a mere fundamental, whether it deals with a fundamental personal right and privilege under the Constitution, or whether it's whether a contract should go forward or some item of federal spending, whether some judge sitting in anywhere in the United States can enjoin an administrative action on a nationwide basis. The substance of the issue, I think there's going to be the way you come down to this question on birthright citizenship, it's going to be, I think, where were the people in the country legally, and do their children have the same rights, as opposed to someone who comes in through a legal process, maybe an asylum seeker, someone that has a temporary protected status, whatever. So there may be a distinction ultimately that the court divines there. I personally do not like the use of executive orders for this. I think that is an overextension of presidential authority. I think if there is a question about whether or not the child of an illegal immigrant has the same rights as someone who came here legally but is not a citizen, whether their child is somehow different from the one of the parents who came in without following the law, that's a question that I think Congress has to decide. And I don't like it being decided vis-a-vis an executive order. So I think, you know, and I've said on this program many times before that I think presidents of both parties and Congress of both parties have allowed presidents to assert jurisdiction and power unduly, and because Congress either shirks its duty or doesn't want to decide. So I don't think this executive order is going to ultimately be upheld.
We heard from Bo and John so far. We will hear from them more. But first, let's check in with Aaron and Teresa. Aaron, you're up.
So I think the use of injunctions is a result of increasingly polarized politics, where federal judges can kind of impose political outcomes on legal decisions. And the fact that, you know, that affects both Democratic and Republican presidents makes this a much broader argument. It's not just these judges are anti-Trump. I don't know the specifics, but I'm pretty sure that this happened a lot under Biden with the student loan forgiveness and some of those other programs. So I want to take a different angle at this point, and that is looking at immigration from an economic perspective and what birthright citizenship could mean for the long-term health of the U.S. economy. So, Bo, I like the terminology used, and I'm going to tweak it a little bit. Yeah. Immigration expands the tent of economic participation. And what all major economies face is a demographic headwind. You've got declining birth rates, you've got rising cost of education, and some of the biggest factors that affect long-run economic growth, so not from one year to the next, but from decade to decade and from generation to generation, is obviously the size of the population, the quality of that population, meaning education levels. And then you've got capital, right? So the capital stock and the quality of those capital goods, namely technology. So when we're talking about birthright citizenship and immigration more broadly, that solves the labor quantity issue, is that you get an influx of workers, you get an influx of business owners, and that expands the tent of economic participation, which allows for modest increases in economic growth Economists have estimated that immigration on net has a very small but positive effect on long-term growth rates. That just, you know, is a demographic tailwind. And during the labor shortage, you can say what you want about Biden's immigration and border policies during his term, but if everybody remembers the 2021, 2022, 2023 labor shortage, where firms were posting that, you know, sorry, we're closed today because we can't find enough workers, that problem would have been substantially worse had it not been for the influx of foreign-born workers that came to the country under Biden administration policies. So, you know, from a purely economic angle, immigration and by extension birthright citizenship, obviously increases the size of the population relative to what it would be in the absence of that and provides a small positive effect on long-term growth rates. So, but, you know, if birthright citizenship ends up being, you know, axed, if there are broader immigration restrictions and acceleration and deportation in the big, beautiful bill, all that's going to do is act as a stronger headwind in terms of slowing long-term economic growth. Narrows the tent of participation.
Bo, do you want to respond to that before we introduce Teresa, or are you just because you nodded?
I'm just super excited about what Aaron's saying. I do have data after Teresa goes that
interested. Ahead. You're on.
Okay, so riffing off what Aaron and what John said, listen to these numbers. So the first couple don't have to pay as much attention to. There have been 127 national injunctions since 1963, 92 since 2001. There were 22 national injunctions during the first Trump administration, 16 under Biden, 17 national injunctions under the second Trump administration. Okay, so it's not a huge number, but then it's not a direct correlation, but let's throw in the numbers about executive orders. So Trump has had 151 executive orders so far. 17, if there's a correlation, 17 of those have been nationally enjoined, right? 162 executive orders under the four-year Biden administration, 16. So 1 in 10 in the Biden administration, 1 in 9 in the second Trump administration. Last numbers, 220 executive orders under the first Trump administration, 22 were enjoined. So it's always about 1 in 10 that are getting enjoined. Yes, those numbers have gone up, and the court is interested in the fact that that's what Sowers, the Solicitor General, is talking about. Too many, too many, too many. But it's a new tool that's being used very equally across administrations. And for that reason, I think the court is just going to throw up their hands and say, okay, we'll just keep national injunctions. Because it's not like it's an anti-Trump thing. They're still, the injunctions are coming at one out of every 10 executive orders.
Teresa?
So I have a question and then comment, but a question on the national injunctions. It just seems to me that it will be difficult to create a one-size-fits-all. Because what you said, John, how does the court have a one-size-fits-all answer on national injunctions? Because isn't an injunction against an executive order having to do with a fundamental change to the Constitution different than maybe a very small aspect of law that they might have to settle? And so how do you – this is not a comment. It's more of a – I was trying to think through this yesterday as I was listening, and I'm glad that you both said that you didn't agree with the, because I didn't have I didn't sense the same direction the court was moving than I was reading in the paper. So I'm glad that you folks who know more about this. But
Has had a four-part test, and I have to say I can't recite all four parts. But generally, it depends upon the magnitude of the issue that's before the court. And so if it's really a more localized issue, or if it's something that really isn't an emergency, something that should be allowed to percolate through the judicial system as opposed to one district court judge in one part of the country making a ruling that's affecting the entire country, that's what I think, especially Justice Thomas, Justice
Alito,
and others have expressed concern about that it really interferes with the proper course of judicial decision making.
Except for when it doesn't, when it's like I'm interrupting you. But this is a how do you do a one? Is there one answer for everything?
There's
injunction?
Not one answer for everything.
And how do you?
The court will likely expand upon its four-part test and come up with a more refined way to analyze these kind of things. And basically what they're doing is they're telling lower court judges, they will be telling, I believe, lower court judges, hey, guys, restrain yourselves.
Be more judicious about
it. Be more judicious about it. And don't think that you can just willy-nilly issue these nationwide injunctions because, you know, frankly, that's not the way in which the system is supposed to operate. I think that's what this court will say ultimately. And it may be a broad, rather broad decision in that regard.
Yeah, and I think, Teresa, I would say one more thing on in addition to what John said, which is that's what the appeals process is about. Now, every single one of them, Elena Kagan is the most vocal about opposition to national injunctions from the left. So it's not just the Alito and Thomases of the world that are skeptical about it. But, and yes, I think the court will chastise lower court judges and say, don't keep doing this unless it's one of these moments where, as I said, injunctions are not all equal. But that's what the appeals process is about. And so that's what I don't understand, where the Solicitor General is thinking, okay, just eliminate it all. And the New Jersey Solicitor General said, you can't have a universal opposition to nationwide injunctions.
And the other effect of the other result of having frequent national injunctions is that more cases get placed on what some have euphemistically called the Supreme Court's shadow docket.
Right.
Because then there's only one way to deal with something when you have a one district court judge issuing a national injunction, and it percolates more quickly up to the Supreme Court. And frankly, I think judges, regardless of their inclination, be it more liberal or more conservative, they like to get things before them that have been thoroughly vetted and argued at the lower court level. You get something on this emergency docket. Well, they haven't had the time to have this thoroughly vetted and researched from a legal standpoint, and you don't have the conflicting arguments that may come from, say, different courts of appeal issuing divergent opinions on a fundamental important matter. So that's why the concern about the so-called shadow docket is directly related to things like these emergency nationwide injunctions.
That was John Faso on the Roundtable panel on Friday, May 16th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, May 16th, Joe was out and Sarah LaDuke hosted. She was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Joseph Palamountain Jr. Chair in Government at Skidmore College, Beau Breslin, attorney and former U.S. Congressperson and NY Assemblyperson John Faso, and Siena College Professor of Economics Aaron Pacitti.
One big, beautiful bill act moving through Congress.
Don't call it that.
That's what it's called.
That's not. Yeah, it's called the Reconciliation Bill. It's marketing, please. Sorry.
Okay.
I'm fanatic about that.
I understand.
Marketing. It's marketing.
House Republicans are preparing to push their hard-fought package for tax breaks and spending cuts through its next hurdle today in the budget committee, but conservatives are warning that they could vote to halt it unless there are further changes. This from the Washington Post. Tallying a whopping 1,116 pages, so quite a tome of an act, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, marketedly named with a nod to President Donald Trump, is teetering at a critical moment. Conservatives are holding out for steeper cuts to Medicaid and other programs to help offset the costs of the tax breaks. But at the same time, lawmakers from high tax states, including New York, are demanding a deeper tax deduction known as SALT for their constituents. Failure to push the package out of the budget committee would be a setback for Speaker Mike Johnson, who insists that Republicans are on track to pass the bill, which he believes will inject a dose of stability into a wavering economy. Teresa.
Yeah, I think let's just talk about the energy and commerce portion. Karen Tumulty from the Washington Post opinion, she has an interesting piece called, and she talks about the Democrats' masterclass in resistance that they did during the markup. Just on the Medicaid portions and the Affordable Care Act, it will throw over 13 million people off of the rolls. They have quote-unquote job requirements, which have been tested in some places. I mean, they're so confident in their job requirements that, interestingly, it appears now in the current version they don't go into effect until after the election. And so because I think they realize that they're going to hurt their own constituents. And they're doing a number of things. They have not been able to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. And so what they're doing is putting all sorts of barriers to entry. They are shortening the amount of time that it's open enrollment. They are dramatically reducing the number of people to assist in open enrollment and making a whole other series of changes. But I think you're seeing just fundamental change across the board, whether it's in Homeland Security, where they want to dramatically reduce funding for FEMA and move it back to the states, and the Department of Education, where they want to eliminate it, move portions of it to other places and move it back to the states. You see it in the EPA. I was listening to their hearing, and all sorts of programs where they've not only rescinded grants that have been awarded, they want to reduce all sorts of departments, and in many cases, they were saying move it back to the states. So you have this pattern of cut the funding, move the responsibility back to the states. So what's the economic and we could go law enforcement too. You know, they were talking about it being law enforcement week and touting the fact that the Republicans support the police and the Democrats don't. But of course, you didn't see that in January 6th, and you don't see that in a number of across the board cuts in their budget, as well as rescinding over $800 million in grants that were already awarded for violence prevention and a whole series of training programs and such. So I think that there's a lot of internal conflict within the Republican Party, both within the House and between the House and the Senate about where this is headed. I think that they are, as a technical matter, they are trying to do too much in one bill. In many cases, some of the members, it seemed that they were surprised at some of the things that are in their proposals were in there. That's happened on both sides of the aisle in the past, but more so here. But the biggest issue is what is the impact going to be of all of these cuts? And just in rural America, for instance, what happens when you have deep cuts in Medicaid at the same time you have deep cuts in the SNAP and food security programs at the same time you have, well, just across the board cuts. And it impacts rural hospitals. They close down. Those rural hospitals are the economic engine for that community. You have job loss. You have job loss, but you have no food security. Oh, you have LIHEAP cut as well. I mean, it's just across the board. It seems like it's a spiraling down, I think it's up to the House Republicans and Senate Republicans to determine whether you want to move forward in this potential spiraling down that will be coming in conjunction with the impact of the tariffs.
John Faso.
Well, I think the fundamental problem is that, and both sides are doing this, but they fail to understand that in fiscal 19, the federal spending was about $4.3 trillion. It's now approaching $7 trillion. The spending increases that occurred because of the pandemic and many of the things that occurred during the pandemic have mostly not been reversed. And I think the problem that we have fundamentally in the country is that we're looking at deficits, annual deficits that are more than $1 trillion. And we're on a pattern, a glide path to having $2 trillion deficits. That's going to create fiscal havoc. It'll potentially cause the dollar to lose its standing as the main means of transaction in the world. And so we have to control the budget and the budget growth. Now, Medicaid is a perfect example. The proposals that they've made in this Medicaid reconciliation package are actually rather modest. I frankly don't know why they've suspended the work rule until 29. That doesn't make any sense to me. I think if you're able-bodied and you're not working and you're not in training and you're not disabled, you should be able to work. And that should be a requirement. The other anomaly, and this came from the Affordable Care Act, when they did the Medicaid expansion, they told states, we're going to reimburse you 90 cents on the dollar for Medicaid. Whereas in New York State, our Medicaid reimbursement for the poor, the mother with three kids who's poor, the person in the nursing home, the disabled person, it's 50 cents on the dollar. So it's created a perverse incentive to drive costs to the Medicaid expansion. There should be some changes there. They didn't even make that change in this proposal. So on SNAP, for instance, they're saying the states, which now don't pay anything for food stamps, that they should have some skin in the game since the states administer the program. It's fully federally funded, but 50-50, the administrative costs are shared between the states and the federal government. There are many states that have error rates that exceed 10-15% in terms of overpayments, even some underpayments, but many states are not processing the SNAP applications on time. So the proposal is not to cut the benefit. It's to say the states, okay, you're administering this program. You're going to now share, you're going to have 75% of the cost to administer the program. We'll pay 25%. And if you administer the program properly with a minimum of errors, we'll pay 95% of the overall cost. So what they're trying to do basically is to shift some of these costs onto the states, in SNAP in particular. But the Medicaid system, anyone who objectively looks at the way the states have manipulated the Medicaid formulas to impose, they impose, in fact, Governor Hochul's budget this year has a new $2.5 or $3 billion tax on managed care organizations. And the tax is really a charade because they impose the tax, it generates a higher federal reimbursement, and then when the federal money comes in, they repay the tax to the entities. There's over $100 billion in the $800 billion annual cost for Medicaid nationally that is going to these so-called intergovernmental transfers, which are just fiscal gimmicks. So, you know, a lot of this is trying to deal with the fact that we have this overall, you know, financial deficit, and we have to address it. And the tax bill, most of the pieces of the tax bill are simply a continuation of current law. Now, we can argue whether, oh, that's a benefit. The Democrats will say, oh, you're trying to do this to give tax cuts to the rich. Well, after the tax cuts were enacted in 2017, the wealthy paid a higher portion of taxes than they did before. And right now, the top 5% pay 40% of the income taxes. They make 27% of the income in the country. The top 10% pay 70% of the income taxes. So our income tax system is heavily progressive, to use that term, not in the local political terms.
In a mathematic sense.
in a mathematical sense. So, you know, if you don't extend the tax, most of the tax provisions from 2017, you wind up with a massive tax increase. So that's really, there's a lot of sleight of hand and dishonesty in the rhetoric on both sides. Let's acknowledge that. But we have to face the fact that we're spending more than we can afford as a country. Federal spending is now 25% of GDP. Before the pandemic, it was 22%. Taxes are about 18% of GDP, and that's not really changed from the 2017 tax cut, which, by the way, I voted against. But be that as it may, this is the fundamental fiscal imbalance we have. We are spending way more than the revenue that we have. And just you're not going to solve it by so-called taxing the rich more, because they are already paying a disproportionate share of the taxes. And that's fine. But to simply say we're just going to tax the rich and that'll solve this problem is simply wrong.
But can I?
Sure.
A couple quick things, John. You can extend some, but not all of the tax cuts. So, for instance, there seems to become bipartisan agreement on the child care tax cut. Maybe not on exactly what it should be, but it should be, right? I don't think anybody says we have. Well, there might be a handful of people, right?
And they have that in this bill as well.
Right. So, but you don't have to. The Republicans are framing it basically as the majority of the Republicans as an all or nothing. Right, that you have to extend all of them or not. And I don't think that that's the case. I think that they could be more judicious about what they do and don't extend, because that did explode the deficits in the last Trump go round. But the other thing is with the Medicaid approach.
See, that's where I disagree with you, because the we produce more revenue after the tax cuts than we had before. So, I mean, I think, you know, given
how, what's
given
the difference between how much did Trump add to the deficits?
He added, and most of it was on the spending side. And, you know, and I've said this before on this program many times, 72% of all federal spending is interest, Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid.
And national defense.
National defense is in the 28% of other spending. National defense is 28, and everything else is 28%. It's Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and interest is 72% of all federal spending. And which side of the budget is growing faster? It's the 72% side. That's the fundamental issue we face.
So Medicaid. Think about what did the Clinton administration do with Medicaid? They went after waste, fraud, and abuse, but in a methodical, really going after waste, fraud, and abuse. They expanded the enforcement folks. They didn't look so much as the patients. They looked at the providers. And that's where the, you know,
that's where
why
most
do you
of
bribe a bank?
Is.
Because that's where the money is,
most
right?
Most of the money is with the providers.
Most of the problem, and I saw that when I worked for the state controller, did audits, and that's where the big money is. And so what did the Clinton team do? They built up the team of people who were focused on waste, fraud, and abuse, and they found, and they controlled some of the spending in that way. But these guys aren't doing that, just like with the IRS going after the those who are not paying their taxes at the upper end.
There's a provision in this bill, for instance, that says they should have a national accuracy clearinghouse for Medicaid and food stamps. And what that means is that if you're living in New York and you're on Medicaid and you move to New Jersey and you apply for Medicaid, New Jersey doesn't know whether the insurer is still getting a payment for you in New York.
Right.
The Wall Street Journal did a front page piece on this about a month ago. It's about if, and they put this provision in, and that's going to save about $30 billion over the next 10 years. You know, is that a cut to Medicaid? No. Even Bernie Sanders would agree that a state shouldn't be paying a capitated payment every month to a managed care organization for someone, the same person in two different states. We're doing the same thing now. They are doing the same thing now with SNAP. So there is a lot, and there's a lot of, you know, this business where we're going to pay a doctor who's affiliated with a hospital who does an outpatient treatment in their doctor's office or their outpatient clinic. We're going to pay them a hospital rate as opposed to an office physician rate. That's a big problem in Medicare, for instance, and that isn't even being touched in this bill. So, you know, there are so many ways in which, but all I'm saying, Teresa, you have very valid points, and I sympathize with, you know, someone that's in a dire situation, but we're spending federal revenue right now, or federal spending is now 25% of GDP. Our revenues are 18% of GDP. And that imbalance is going to kill our kids and grandchildren.
But I think we have some agreement here. I think there are ways that you can address the Medicare system, address the Medicaid system that wrings out some of that true waste, fraud, and abuse without disrupting patient care. And because if you kick off 13 million or more, many millions of people off the system, they're still going to need health care. And so what are they going to do? They're going to go back through the emergency room. And that's the most expensive way to do it. Or they're not going to get care. They're going to delay it until they're much sicker. And that's the most expensive. And what's the impact on health centers, rural hospital, urban health centers, right? Then you get this cascading effect. It's better to have people insured, but go after, you know, where...
Right.
Go after where the problems are, which is on the provider
side. Let me give you another problem. During the pandemic, the Congress and the Biden administration suspended eligibility determinations for Medicaid. So for 3 years, no one was redetermined whether they were eligible. It's estimated that there were 15 to 18 million people still on the Medicaid rolls who are no longer eligible because they don't meet the income qualifications. This bill is going to not only restore an annual recertification, but say you have to recertify every 6 months. And if you have the right technology and you use AI properly, you can assist in making these determinations.
Except for what's the calculation of how many people that's going to drive off the rolls because it's complicated to do and because you have people who are living at the margins. And the numbers are very high in terms of that provision, how many that's going to drive off the rolls. Yeah, I can't remember it off the top of my head. But it's a high number, John. It's well-intended. Just like the work requirement, well-intended, but how they execute it is going to drive people off the rolls. And that's expensive to the system.
And well-executing government systems is often a, you know, its own contradiction in terms.
That's an oxymoron.
Right. Yeah.
before John goes, fascinating conversation, but can I throw a question to you?
Sure.
That is, I sort of call what we've seen lately, sort of Kevin McCarthy and all the way up through now, politics by the tail end of both parties, right? And so you have members of the Republican Party who are holding out. They're actually doing their job. Like Mike Lawler's doing his job. He's supposed to be representing the local district on questions of state and local tax benefits, but he's holding the Republicans hostage in some ways.
It's a negotiation.
It's a negotiation, sure. Do you see that as problematic if we continue down the path of the tails holding on to?
I really don't. And you know, look, everyone out there who's on the salt issue, remember when they capped salt at $10,000, they also in that bill eliminated the alternative minimum tax for most people. And the alternative minimum tax, what did that do? It put back in the calculation of your taxes you no longer had a deduction for your state and local taxes because of the alternative minimum tax. So just simply restoring an unlimited salt deduction without putting the alternative minimum tax back in is highly costly and would be very inefficient. So I think that, you know, the tax system is really complicated and there are many pieces that you know, work together. But there are other things that are contradictory. And I do think the salt piece, they're up to 30,000. I think there's room for a little more. And I think the New Yorkers will get a little more. But you can't get everything they want. And you certainly can't restore the alternative minimum tax, which was a terrible tax policy.
What about the process question, John, of having so much in one bill to tackle?
It's bad.
Bad. And I think we hopefully can all agree that
it's the big bad bill.
It's too much.
But how are you going to? I mean,
so many pages.
You have the conservative Republicans on one end saying we absolutely are not going to vote for this because it's not enough cuts, and then the moderate saying we're absolutely not going to vote for this because some of the cuts go too deep and too much is sent back to the states without the ability to pay. I can't get over the deep cuts in NOAA with the Weather Service. Can't everybody agree we should not be decimating them? But as a process question, John, I mean, where is this going? Is it the Titanic that Senator Johnson said, you know, the House bill's a Titanic, it's sinking and we have to start again? Or
what are your parting words for today,
John? Where do you think this is all headed?
I think they're ultimately going to compromise and resolve their differences and pass something. They've got to pass this by the August recess, frankly, because if they don't, politically for them, it's a disaster because there won't be certainty that businesses and taxpayers have out there as to making investments in the economy, and that will be a negative for them in the midterms. So they've got to have certainty in taxation, particularly business depreciation and things like that. They've got to have certainty in order to create more assurance where the economy is going.
But do they bifurcate it like the Senate wants, one bill?
I think they're going to do one bill, and when the president comes back from his trip, hopefully he and others will focus on getting the compromises that will be necessary, making this sausage in this process. It's not pretty. It's what Bismarck supposedly said one time, that the two things that people should never see being made are their laws and something else.
Sausage.
Laws
and sausage.
He was German, so that's a good guess.
That was Beau Breslin on the Roundtable panel on Friday, May 16th. full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at WAMC.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.